You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
This week, there was a devastating earthquake in Haiti, a natural disaster that has caused the deaths of tens of thousands of Haitians and shattered the capital city of Port-au-Prince. Yet the Haitian people have already suffered more than enough human-made disasters, and the consequences of nature have been magnified by those preceding human-made disasters. Stuart Hammond returned earlier this month from Haiti, where he traveled as a member of an international delegation of South American solidarity activists. Before the earthquake struck, we had invited him to provide a picture of the then-current social and political conditions in Haiti. Stuart is a member of the Canada-Haiti Action Network and Haiti Solidarity BC. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, what were living conditions like prior to the earthquake?
For the poor majority of Haitians in Port-au-Prince, our delegation mainly visited Port-au-Prince and the capital and a city called Jacmel in the south. Living conditions were terrible. Beyond the poor construction of houses, basically just made out of concrete or just shacks, there was little access to potable water. That has to be bought. You can buy treated water if you can afford it. There's no access to health care. There's no access to education. There's no access to formal employment. People just told us again and again that they had no contact with their government. Fellow government had totally abandoned them, and they had no contact also with aid organizations.
Has it gotten worse in recent years?
Our delegation was there to ask about conditions since the 2004 coup d'etat. So yeah, we always tried to find out, well, how have things gotten worse or better, or how have conditions changed since then? And people really focused on the 2006 period onward, which is when now President René Préval was elected. He was elected during that election. The Lavalas party of Aristide, the ousted president, was excluded from the elections, and people voted for Préval as a kind of substitute, as the next best possible option. And people were initially very hopeful that he would improve things, and that did not happen at all. And in recent years, people have really become extremely angry at him. I should clarify, rather than their anger was at him, but really they saw him as controlled by the Haitian elite and by the U.S. government. And we heard that again and again. We don't really think Préval is running the show. Other people are. And they are ignoring us, and worse than ignoring us, attacking our ways of livelihood. We had many interviews with Haiti's unemployment is probably about 70 or 80%. So in fact, people work in what's called the informal economy, just reselling things, selling vegetables. Those people, we met with associations of merchants, of small merchants, and they said, you know, our markets have been attacked, our inventory has been burned by bandits, they would say, but we don't get any help from the police and we don't get any help from the government. And what we think is behind this is the large merchants, the rich Haitian elite families who want to destroy our markets and replace them with their own large markets where everything is more expensive and where we can't make any money. So that's just one example of how bad conditions were getting. During the coup period, 2004-2006, people were afraid for their lives. But now, in that post-2006 period, people really felt that their lives and their ways of livelihood were being crushed out of existence. I mean, it was really despairing to hear from people.
Now, as you said, in 2004, there was the coup, and the governments of Canada, the U.S., and France organized the kidnapping and forced deportation of Haiti's democratically elected president, Jean-Paul Aristide, in the name of democracy. What has happened since then in the democratic life of Haiti?
Well, that's it's been another huge problem. As I mentioned, the 2006 elections excluded the most popular political party in Haiti, Famille Lavalas. I mean, that's the popularity of that party is so large that, you know, even the mainstream press here, Associated Press and Reuters, will say, they are the most popular political party. But if you talk to people there, I mean, yeah, they basically the majority of the poor are Lavalas supporters. They were excluded from that 2006 election. There have been subsequent elections, often delayed, April 2009, and there was an election scheduled for February 28th, 2010, which won't happen now, which had also excluded Lavalas. And people were so outraged at that. Canada was actually the main organizer and one of the main funders of the April 2009 election. And, you know, if people listening today have had the experience of traveling abroad, most people in most countries don't know a lot about Canada. And it was just absolutely chilling to hear Haitians be able to name Canada by name as a country that is harming them. They knew our political policies and they knew what our political policies were trying to do. So people were absolutely outraged by this April 2009 election. That was also a turning point for a lot of Haitians with Obama. We heard people say, we expected the first black president of the United States to help the first black republic in the world, which is Haiti. And after that April election, people realized, well, we might as well have Bush in the White House. They were absolutely devastated. So many Haitians had believed that Obama's election would make a difference for them, and it didn't. So the democratic life of Haiti has continued to exclude Lavalas. The April elections there was a formal boycott by Lavalas and popular movements. Voting rate, the official rate was 10% of people voted, but it's really estimated that it was closer to about 2 or 3%. Nevertheless, the 11 senators elected in that election were recognized by the government and recognized by Canada, the United States. Haiti immediately put in a new prime minister, who was Jean-Max Bellerive, who was in Canada about a month ago, recognized and meeting with all our high officials. So yeah, that exclusionary policies have continued.
Tell me a bit about the election that was to have taken place in February.
So this upcoming election, scheduled election, was for 98 of 99 seats in Haiti's lower house, and I think about another third of the Senate was going to be reelected. It was called, as opposed to the April election, which I think had originally been scheduled for 2007, this one was called quite quickly. Haiti has something called a provisional electoral council. I stress the word provisional. Its constitution stipulates a permanent electoral council, but it hasn't had that in years and years and years. So this provisional electoral council, which in this case had been handpicked by René Préval, had just, as it had in the April elections, excluded Lavalas. In the April elections, it provided some kind of technical reasons, which kept shifting, why they excluded Lavalas. This time around, they just did not even bother to release anything. So these elections, the popular movements were just mobilizing to deal with them. We witnessed a protest by, I would say, movements that would be Lavalas supporters, although it wasn't the Lavalas party itself. People can go to vancouverhaiti.blogspot.com. It's a site I was blogging and see some photographs of that protest with people holding signs saying, U.S., Canada, don't fund this February 28th electoral masquerade. So those protests were just really starting to get organized. I think the official Famille Lavalas spokespeople were just trying to decide a strategy excuse me, for that election. I assume that basically, the strategy of April would continue a boycott of the election.
To what extent does the government function in people's lives in Haiti?
Yeah, not at all. That was a consistent message. We met with women's groups, with peasants, with prisoner rights groups. Again and again, people would tell us, you know, we have all these laws, they're not enforced. We should have access to jobs, to education. Haitians take their human rights very seriously, and they see access to education, access to employment as a human right. Peasants and the majority of the Haitian population lives in the countryside said, you know, we are farming as we did decades, if not, you know, hundreds of years ago. We haven't seen any help. We need help from our government. We don't see them. And one thing we did hear from most groups is, the election of Aristide in 1990 and again in 2000, I mean, he wasn't given time or resources to do a lot, but that was the first time people, and perhaps the only time people had actually seen government officials that would go back and talk to them and begin to start projects. So again and again, we would meet people who said, you know, here's a document we have. This is when a representative of the Aristide government started meeting with our school. Here's where an Aristide government official met with us in the countryside and, you know, started to help us with agronomy and things like that. So the current government now, people just felt it was a it was totally useless. They were really angry at it and that it didn't help them at all.
Now, your delegation had a special interest in gathering testimony about human rights abuses by the UN military force that was established in Haiti immediately after the 2004 coup. Mm-hmm. What did you find?
So the UN military force, about 9,000 soldiers, mostly Brazilian, but also from countries like Bolivia, the Philippines, a lot of their Latin American countries. There had been reports of two large massacres in 2005, 2006 in a poor neighborhood in Port-au-Prince called Cité Soleil. We met with many survivors of those massacres, but we also heard from many other people of other smaller attacks on the neighborhood of Bel Air, another poor neighborhood in Port-au-Prince, another kind of Lavalas stronghold. But also we heard from the countryside that there'd be flare-ups, there was a protest a few months ago in the Central Plateau region over an electrical plant, and I believe two Haitians were shot there. Father Gerard Jean-Just, a Lavalas activist who passed away of cancer, at his funeral ceremony, the UN shot a person taking part in that ceremony, in the funeral procession. The people we met with, just some horrible, horrible wounds they had suffered. And of course, they don't get any medical aid after that. Some of them had emergency triage aid from organizations like Doctors Without Borders, but there's no functioning medical system in Haiti, and there's no ability to do kind of reconstructive surgery. So people had bullets lodged in them still, massive scars. We met a young man who was paralyzed, living in a shack in Bel Air, and just said, you know, what can you guys do for me? And we said, well, you know, what about Doctors Without Borders? He said, I've already seen them. They've told me they can't do anything for me. I want to get this bullet out of me, and I want to be able to walk again. I was just talking about the informal sector in Haiti. I mean, that's where most of the jobs are. But if you're handicapped, you're pushed out of even that. So, yeah, we met a lot of young men with bullet wounds, with, you know, their legs had been injured. In this one case, this one man paralyzed. In Cité Soleil, we met women. In one horrible case, you can, again, see this on VancouverHaiti.blogspot.com. This one woman, Leylen, who'd been shot in her stomach. She had been pregnant at the time. She lost the child, but, I mean, incredibly and horrifically, the fact that she was pregnant is what saved her life. The baby absorbed some of the impact of the bullet. We saw the UN all over the place in Haiti. I mean, it's, you know, none of us were threatened personally, but you just see people drive by in a back of a pickup truck with huge rifles. You know, it's chilling to see that. And that's what most Haitians feel as well. A lot of reports we hear is that, you know, the UN, a lot of them, they don't speak, they're from all sorts of countries. They don't speak French. They don't speak Creole, which is the language the majority of Haitians speak. So it's they can't even communicate. So I'm sure some of these incidents were just these young UN soldiers who got scared and shot at Haitians. Another case, I think it was very organized raids in neighborhoods where houses are just made of wood or flimsy concrete, and bullets, any bullets that go astray, just rip into houses and rip into people.
Into this horrific situation, this lack of government, this lack of medical infrastructure, we now have a devastating earthquake.
Yeah.
So what have you heard from people?
When I heard of this earthquake on the 12th, on Tuesday, I believe, I had just emailed with a friend in Haiti. I immediately tried to call down there, but listeners have probably heard, phone lines have just been totally destroyed, and satellite phones. excuse me. We're getting some reports back now. Some of the people we met have survived. The majority we haven't heard from, and we have to fear the worst. But what we're hearing part of me naively wanted to believe that, you know, this massive influx of aid would really change things, but unfortunately it's just magnified the situation. There's a situation that people aren't getting help from their government or from aid groups. We've heard from one teacher and organizer, her name is Rhea Dole, at the Sopidep School. Her family survived. The school, amazingly enough, didn't collapse. It's now being used as a makeshift hospital. She said, we haven't seen any foreign aid workers helping us. Her quick report was just that they don't really seem to be leaving the area around the neighborhood, around the airport, rather. And those reports are starting to appear in some Western media as well. If you look at the Independent journal from the UK, and if you look at a report on the CanadaHaitiAction.ca website, we have another report about that out in the poor neighborhoods, there's basically no aid workers. It's Haitians mobilizing and organizing for themselves with nothing. They don't have, you know, they're just doing their best to stabilize people, but they don't have any medical equipment. I also heard back from we had stayed at a guest house in Port-au-Prince run by an American nun who was a nurse. She survived. The guest house was minorly damaged. She is now doing triage in the soccer field next to the guest house. She's describing the wounds. As I mentioned, a lot of the houses there are made of flimsy concrete. These concrete blocks are falling on people's heads. So the most common injury is just horrific head wounds. She said, I'm surprised that a lot of these people are alive. She said, we've run out of any kind of medical equipment. I mean, this was just a guest house. They don't have anything beyond sheets, really. She said, though, that it's the Haitians again. Even, you know, she reports 3-year-old children are doing what they can to help build splints. You know, just amazing community spirit, but no materials. And that's really the story we heard from Haitians. They themselves, their organizational abilities are incredible, but they don't get any outside help. And yet, Haiti is awash in NGOs, and the UN is there. And, you know, since the coup, it's been Canada's second largest foreign aid commitment after Afghanistan, so-called foreign aid. So how does all this happen? I mean, that's really one of the big questions we have to ask.
If we want to send aid down there, are there places we can send it that will actually get through to people?
Yeah, this turns out to be a really difficult question. If you go to the CanadaHaitiAction.ca website, we've listed a few organizations. One of them is Partners in Health, which in Haiti is called Zami La Santé. They've been down in Haiti for decades now. We've worked with them in the past. They work with the Haitian grassroots. Their model is, we want to train an organization and build an organization that if all the Westerners left, it would continue, because we've trained the Haitian community health workers and so on. So I think that's a trustworthy organization. I mean, what we really need to do is to get aid to the Haitian grassroots, to people like Rhea Dole at Sopidep. You can read about on the CanadaHaitiAction.ca website. We are the Sawatsky Family Foundation in Canada, was one of the funders of Rhea Dole and Sopidep. Ryan Sawatsky is trying to coordinate as best he can with Rhea now to get aid to her. There's also the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, which is a fund out of the United States, started by Danny Glover and other Haiti activists, that does try to fund the Haitian grassroots organizations. So you can look at those as well. I mean, I, of course, it's such a difficult position. I encourage everybody to give aid. But aid is a political issue, and it's a really complicated issue. This was something I was hoping to investigate when I got back, the role of NGOs, because I heard from so many people that the NGOs do not play a helpful role in Haiti, so it just turns out to be so difficult. So yes, look at this website, donate to some of these organizations, but you know, really what I want from people is a long-term attention to Haiti and long-term commitment to Haiti. You know, do what you can to read about Haiti, and then, you know, you will spontaneously, from your heart and from genuinely caring, you know, write to the MPs, write to the NGOs in the future, maintain that pressure. And we have to change Canada's policy to Haiti drastically. So that's the best aid that people could give right now, because we have to let the grassroots in Haiti rebuild. And this has been such a devastating event. but it is going to be the grassroots that rebuild the country. And we need to make that long-term commitment to help them. So beyond this immediate aid, yes, there are organizations you can give to, but that's the larger struggle for sure, is to support these grassroots. So I think I would pass those two messages along to listeners. Yes, there are organizations you can support, but give that long-term, your caring and your solidarity with Haiti. I mean, that's what Haiti really needs from you.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Stuart Hammond. He's active in Haiti Solidarity BC. And I'll give you that website again that you can go to find organizations to send funds to. It's CanadaHaitiAction.ca. Stuart's going to be speaking on the situation in Haiti at a public meeting in February. It's on Friday, February 5th in Collingwood near the SkyTrain station at 5288 Joyce Street, starting at 7, but we will give you more information about that also closer to the time.